Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn, and you are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Tuesday, the 30th of November. Our guest this hour is Professor Han S. Park, Professor of International Affairs, Director of the Center for the Study of Global Issues at the University of Georgia, and North Korea, South Korea, China, the United States, Japan, and Russia will be the focus of our conversation this hour, particularly the relationship between North Korea and South Korea and how to prevent an all-out war in that part of the world. He was our guest, born in China to immigrant Korean parents. He was educated in China, Korea, and the United States, and he has visited North Korea many times since 1981. When President Carter made a visit to North Korea in 94, Professor Park secured his invitation from the North Korean government and briefed him prior to his departure. He has made many efforts to promote U.S.-Northern Korea relations through academic exchanges, mutual visits by opinion leaders. He is the founding president of Uniting Families. He led a U.S. agricultural team to North Korea with the goal of alleviating hunger. And he's focused research on human rights, sustainable development, and East Asian politics. He joins us by phone today from Ottawa, where the Canadian government has asked him to brief them on North Korea. Our phone number for this conversation is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. And if you would like to send an email, you can do that. That's talk@wpr.org. talk@wpr.org. Professor Han S. Park, thank you so much for joining us again.
Thank you for inviting me again.
I would imagine that you, sir, are very much in demand these days.
Yeah, I'm a little busy.
Yeah, I would imagine. More than a little busy. How do you interpret what has happened in the last couple of weeks? Are you concerned about an all-out war between the North Korea and South Korea?
Yeah, I think all-out war is a very vague concept, but the escalation of conflict is very likely, unless something happens next few days. As we speak, the joint military exercise is underway. It will last until Friday. I'm very concerned because it's a tit-for-tat kind of more emotional confrontation, and not really big issue involved here, such as the nuclear security issue. This is more emotional kind of thing. Not many people in the United States or Western world realizes the fact that North Korea has been saying that they did react to South Korean provocation. Officially, they issued a statement to that effect, and United Nations, their diplomats are saying that all along. But I think we have to inquire about what are they talking about. In fact, you inquired about it. It's not that big deal. It could have been avoided very easily. In a nutshell, what happened was there is a territorial water just under the demarcation called Northern Limit Line, NLL, that was drawn by the United States and its allies right after the Korean War. They agreed that they, meaning North Korea and America and American allies, agreed on the demarcation line on land, but they neglected to draw a line in the ocean. Mm. So at that time, the United Nations forces drew unilaterally a line which, in North Korea's mind, is unfairly intruding their coast. In the meantime, North Korea also issued more like what they considered to be a legitimate line, which was much south of the NLL. So the between the two lines, that is territorial waters, that is in dispute. Over the decades, there have been abductions, arrests of fishermen, both sides. So this is disputed area. Then the military exercise is taking place in an area that includes this area. So North Koreans had issued the warnings to the South Korean government, if you should proceed with this exercise, we will consider that to be military provocation. Of course, South Korea ignored that and carried on. And North Korea, of course, bombed that island, Yeonpyeong. But that was what happened. And I'm not saying their response in the form of attacking that island, killing some civilians also, is justified whatsoever. But it's incorrect to say that North Korea did it out of blue, just attacked the South Korean sovereign territory. It's a little distorted view.
When you say that this was an emotional confrontation, what do you mean by that?
You see, North and South Korea, actually, the relationship may best be defined as a legitimacy war. Each side claims the entire peninsula to be its territory, and also being same, it's a kind of family feud, if you will. A much more emotional thing is involved here. So, you know, the face-saving mutually is so important. Now, North Koreans are saying if you continue this joint practice, which is underway right now, we will not tolerate. We'll do something about that. Because they believe if they tolerated this, nothing happened, then the disputed territorial waters may be de facto, you know, considered as a part of South Korea. So they cannot just sit idle. That's what they're saying.
I see.
So they're almost you know, forced to do something about this. And the South Korean president have said that recently has said that you know, if there's another provocation from the North, then there will be massive retaliation. So that is all out war. So it's a very tense moment at this time, next few days, and maybe next couple of weeks, it's a very critical time.
Right. Why can't they figure out where the water line should be? This war's been over for a long, long time. Why is that so difficult?
You know, territorial waters, there are international laws and conventions and all that. It's always hard to have consensus on because the economic right, fishery and so forth, security and so forth. But the problem in this case is they have never sat down for the purpose of sorting out the differences and discussing this. And this is a perfect occasion. Now the world is paying attention to this. It's time for us to cool down and sit down, collect all the facts and claims from all parties. And that's what China is trying to accomplish right now as we speak. I think it's a very good gesture to have a multilateral international meeting to alleviate this crisis.
And does it need to be more than China? Should the U.S. and Japan and Russia be at those talks as well?
Basically, I think it is the United States and North Korea, and secondarily South Korea and China, because the United States and North Korea were the signatories to the armistice agreement in 1953. But today's political dynamism would suggest that South Korea, China should also be involved in sorting out the problems. China also recently claimed that this area also belongs to its so-called economic zone, whatever that is. So this is a very hotly contested area and an issue. So international panel of authorities and experts should sit down and then discuss this matter. This kind of thing should be a matter of public debate. But we don't know anything about what's going on. I think it's a mistake, and journalists and reporters should look into this.
Well, journalists and reporters have a difficult time, don't they, trying to figure out what's going on in North Korea because it's hard even to enter the country. How do you find out the truth?
No, North Korea itself, you're absolutely right. It's hard to get in there, and it's practically impossible to find those facts on the ground. But this matter is a disputed area. This is a matter of international law, and there's nothing secretive about North Korean claims and their contentions, the basis on which they base their claims. There's nothing confidential or unknown about. And I think we should discuss these matters, at least. Inside North Korea is a different matter.
Professor Park, there has been much in the press about Kim Jong-il's successor, his young son,
right,
and the timing of all of this, that he had to prove that he was a tough guy. So the attack was initiated to show the North Korean people, this man who's in charge is going to protect you. He's going to be tough.
There's certain element of that. I really think that North Korean, the effort to build leadership and the charisma around this young man may require such a demonstration. But Kim Jong-un's base of authorities saw this kind of demonstration, I don't know, will help him establish the kind of charisma needed in that kind of system. He has a long way to go. But I don't think it was a premeditated kind of plan designed to beef up his authority.
Mm-hmm. There is a story today as this WikiLeaks story keeps getting bigger as people go through the hundreds of thousands of pages. I'm wondering if you make any of what do you make of this? With North Korea reeling from economic and succession crises, American and South Korean officials early this year secretly began gaming out what would happen if the North, led by one of the world's most brutal family dynasties, collapsed. They said that after the death of Kim Jong-il, there would probably be a collapse of the North Korean government and a chance for reunification then and with the South. Was that just two people talking about what they would like to have happen, or do you think there's truth in that?
In terms of perception level, I think there is a lot of truth in that, because outside North Korea, South Korea, and the United States in particular, especially in the conservative circles, there are a lot of people who think that North Korea should collapse, cannot tolerate such a bad system, rogue state, to maintain an existence in the global community today. But no one is saying out loud, because the ramifications of such a collapse are simply unacceptable. It's going to be South Korea may go down the drain along with North Korea, because the burden is too heavy. And then China certainly cannot accept that. But those talks are going on. In a way, this WikiLeaks kind of thing is a blessing, because, the real talks are going on behind the scene, and the public should be informed of some of these. And I think in this case, in Korean case, it's a good thing, because then the debate over the collapsibility of North Korea will become more overt. And I like to see more intellectual experts and, you know, journalists debate on the question, will North Korea collapse? If it does, what will happen?
Right. And when you say that the burden for South Korea could be too big a burden, what's their burden? What would their burden be?
First of all, economically, if you compare the German case, West Germany was substantially bigger and stronger in terms of size of relative size of population, as well as size of economy. In the case of Korea, North Korea is a very large in comparison with East Germany, relatively, and the economy is much more impoverished, so that the economic burden on the part of South Korea will be large. But more than that, much more important thing is it will be a mess. The society, the unified community will not be able to maintain stability and then safety there, because North Koreans, it's a weird from people from outside. North Koreans tend to believe that the South Korean prosperity is because of they're maintaining strong security posture, including the nuclear weapons, that would have prevented, according to North Koreans, prevented American provocation and thus another military.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah, and then South Korean economic progress would not have been the case. So the point is, some North Koreans, a lot of them believe that South Korean wealth is not entirely, it doesn't entirely belong to South Korea only. So, so we will have a lot of social, economic, turmoil should North Korea collapse.
We're going to welcome phone calls. We already have many of our lines humming. Professor Han Park is our guest. He's professor of international affairs, director of the Center for the Study of Global Issues at the University of Georgia. He, perhaps more than any other human being, has visited North Korea many, many times, and he has secured some important negotiations between American leaders and the press and allowed them to be able to go into the country and meet with top-level officials there. Also, his personal background is fascinating, I think. He was born in China, his parents immigrant Koreans, and he's been educated in China, Korea, and the United States. Here's our phone number, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email address is talk@wpr.org. Professor Park is joining us by phone from Ottawa, where the Canadian government has asked Professor Park to brief them on North Korea. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We start our calls with Mike from Appleton. Hi, Mike.
Yeah, good morning. Professor, that was a very interesting perspective, the first part that you said. Just goes to show you there's always two sides to every story. Having said that, though, it would seem to me that but probably the Chinese are the ones who have the most influence over North Korea. And it's from my perspective, it would seem that they want to play this out as long as they can, because the last thing they want is a unified Korea and the possibility of having, you know, a democracy right on their border backed by the United States.
Professor Park.
China. We tend to romanticize the influence of China over North Korea. China does not have that much an influence, nor does it want to exert its influence. China works for its own national interest. Of course, China is for denuclearization of North Korea, no question about that. China wants to remain the sole nuclear power in the region. China may not want to see unified Korea going liberal democracy, as the caller suggested. I agree certainly with that. China, at the same time, doesn't want to see North Korea to collapse. China supports Kim Jong-il, support this kind of succession. The young Kim visited China, met with Chinese leadership, and secured their blessings, their support. The long-held Chinese foreign policy principle has been that it doesn't interfere with domestic affairs. Sometimes they think conveniently inter-Korea relationship as being domestic affairs. I think Chinese influence and China wants to avoid any kind of suggestion or impression that China is doing what America wants it to do. Unlike decades ago, China is very assertive as a major international force.
Professor Park, tell me more about how dependent or not North Korea is on China for economic aid.
Yes. As far as the dependence, the level of dependence, yes, China has a lot of clout there. But that doesn't mean that China is going to actually exert influence. And it's very reluctant over historically to exert influence on other systems. Economically, some 80% of electricity is coming from China.
Oh, my.
I would suspect, I don't have hard facts, no one does in that. I think a significant amount of North Korean food crisis has been alleviated by food aid from China, which, of course, offset American and the South Korean and United Nations embargoes. So of late, last couple of years, especially this year, Kim Jong-il made two trips to China and had meetings both times with Hu Jintao. And I'm pretty sure there has been very good agreement as far as economic cooperation, economic assistance is concerned.
Mike, thanks for the call. Scott in La Crosse. Hi, Scott.
Hi, Kathleen. Thanks so much. I, as it turns out, even right now, have been listening to an audio book called Nothing to Envy, Ordinary Lives of People in North Korea by Barbara Dimmock. She's an L.A. Times reporter covering that part of Asia. And her book, she interviews a half dozen refugees because there's really no way to talk to people in North Korea, but these are people who have North Koreans who are now living, I guess, mostly in South Korea, and presents their stories, and it is so bizarre and so frightening and really horrific, the kind of lives these people have led. And what I'd like to ask Professor Park is he familiar with Barbara Dimmock's book, and does she have a pretty good story if he is familiar with it? And a particular aspect of this that intrigued me was that she said prior to the collapse of the Soviet Union and the end of the Cold War that both China and Russia, through what they called, quote, friendship pricing, in other words, deeply discounted energy supplies being provided to the North Koreans, were allowing them to have a, if not prosperous, at least stable and functioning economy, and that when that pricing ended, that basically triggered the collapse and the starvation and the shutting down of all the industry and the end result of, you know, because everything was state run, so the, you know, all the manufacturing stopped. Farming stopped. People started to starve to death. So essentially, these folks living there now, for most of them, they've seen all this happen in their lifetime. And I guess my question is that the accurate story on it, and what the implications of that are going forward for any kind of change if they survive, if this regime has survived that starvation and things have stabilized now, what is the feeling that they would actually collapse at this point?
Thank you, Scott.
Wow. He touched on a lot of issues there.
Mm-hmm.
That book he was referring to portrays. I'm familiar with the author as well as the work. Portrays one aspect of North Korea as depicted by refugees. Now, one pathetic thing about the level of information or paucity of information outside North Korea is that we often too heavily rely on testimonials given by these defectors, these refugees. It doesn't take any brainer to figure out the truth that these defectors have come out of North Korea for good reason. These reasons are not really good memories, good accounts of North Korea whatsoever. So I think, distorted. When I kind of counter these things, people think I am too sympathetic. I am trying to be very empathetic, not necessarily sympathetic, but empathetic. I have traveled to North Korea, different corners and countryside, and observed different aspects of North Korea. It's not that monolithic system. You have different pockets of people doing better than others. It's quite decentralized in terms of economic situation and conditions. So it's very hard to characterize North Korea with one stroke, a starving country. The earlier observation that when the Soviets and Chinese were supporting North Korea prior to the demise of the Soviet Union, of course, North Korea received technological, economic, and food aid from these countries, very much so. Especially the food aid from China coming from northeastern three provinces of China was very substantial. But after the China became much more interested in cash income rather than free food aid, and the Soviet Union no longer there, then North Korea tried to cultivate more land and food by cutting down all the trees in the mountains. I've traveled all over North Korea, and lasted a year or two until the topsoil washed down, and all the rivers, creeks were flooded. That really contributed to massive flooding and further deterioration of food situation in 1990s. So that is true. This is a failed economy. Without the international support system that it did have during the Cold War, North Korea is struggling, no question about
it. Mm-hmm. Because you are one of the few people on Earth who has been to North Korea so many times, I'm just interested. So many of us don't know what's going on there. We see some pictures when television crews are able to enter of fairly bizarre scenes with the family seemingly being glorified and marches on the streets. We see very little beyond that. We hear about excessive hunger, etc. Do you feel that it's a creepy place where people are under the thumb of their rulers and can't express themselves and have no access to the outside world?
Or in a way, it is much more, I guess, the authorities much more deeply penetrating into the population, especially its mind and souls, for such a long time. Political education or indoctrination or whatever you want to call, has had advanced to a point where North Koreans do not have to be coercively mobilized. They voluntarily submit themselves to the authority, especially in the context of Confucian civilization. It's not very hard to secure such a political environment. So in North Korea, I don't think there is necessarily such an iron, fist coercion there to generate people's support. It's more voluntary by now. So it's very skillfully they politically educated people so that there's no problem in terms of divisiveness of public opinion on the authority.
Scott, always, thank you for your call. Tracy in Rhinelander, hi.
Yeah, a couple quick questions. Thank you very much for the opportunity. The island that was shelled with the artillery, I heard in a news report that that was in the disputed area. And it seems to me if I were going to shell an island that was disputed, I'd pretty much say that it's not disputed anymore. It must be along the south because I wouldn't be shelling my own property. And then the other related to that is... I assume the south wants a line heading west, or let's say northwest out into the ocean over by China. Why can't the two north and south just draw the lines that they want, and then the international committee force them to just divide it in right down the middle between where they both want it to be until, I guess, one takes over the other or one collapses? Appreciate the call. Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks, Tracy, for the call.
I think that would have been the suggestion. North and South Korea sit down, draw their line would have been great. They missed the opportunity last 8-10 years. Kim Dae-jung and Roh Moo-hyun, more progressive regimes, were in South Korea. But unfortunately, the fact of the matter is they've never discussed this matter. This is not, a large territory, never discussed until there's some military issues emerge like we see today. So that would have been, and still, I think that is a great solution. Now, as far as the Yeonpyeong Island belonging to North Korea, South Korea, yes, that's technically North Koreans think it's theirs, and South Koreans think it's theirs. But at the time of military exercise, in preparation of the military exercise, South Korean military based its kind of strategic control headquarters or some military value on the island. So North Koreans targeted the military component of the in the island, and certainly they did not. I don't think they there aren't very many civilians, but military these buildings were totally annihilated, as I believe. Yes, it's why they destroyed their own people. Were South Korean people at the time, and of course South Koreans with all the economic and ability and so forth, have exerted more influence, more utilization of the disputed waters than North Koreans have.
You have said that no one seems to be doing anything constructive here unless we, America, change our approach to the Korean Peninsula. There's no guarantee that a major military confrontation could be avoided. What do we need to do today?
I think there are only three solutions. One, go and destroy North Korea completely, which is not acceptable solution, unthinkable. And then, of course, that would involve retaliation from North Korea. You have tens of thousands, guns pointing at major areas in South Korea, and including, missile-guided precision missiles there. So all-out Korean war is unacceptable. And secondly, don't do anything. Just maintain status quo. Inaction is no inaction anymore. When we haven't done anything, North Korea in the meantime became a nuclear power, tested a couple, and then you have uranium-based development. All these are happening. So inaction is not going to be productive. And then what do we do? We'd have to talk to them. Even if we fight, we have to invite to the tables, either bilateral, multilateral, it doesn't matter. But that's what we're not doing. Washington should engage these bad guys, with a dialogue, that's what we have to do.
And this administration, before they entered office, said that they would do just that, didn't they?
Exactly. President Obama certainly promised to change. That's a great change, included foreign policy arena. But so far, 2 years or so, the Obama administration hasn't done anything different from the Bush administration. And I think it's a time to be a little more creative and assertive.
I guess this hour, as we talk about North and South Korea, Professor Han Park, Professor of International Affairs, Director of the Center for the Study of Global Issues at the University of Georgia. He has traveled to North Korea many, many, many times, and he is today briefing the Canadian government on North Korea. Thank you for your call, Tracy. I think we should send Tracy into the negotiations. Our phone number, we have one line open for you, is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Email address, use that if you'd like, talk@WPR.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Our next caller is Pat from Oshkosh. Hi, Pat.
Good morning, Kathleen, Professor Park. Last evening I was watching the BBC World News, and back to the WikiLeaks, I tuned in a little late. I didn't hear what you were discussing earlier. But it sounds like, from what I heard, that China was made, or at least the Chinese diplomats that were recorded in these WikiLeaks, were considering the concept of reunification because once the leader, Kim Jong-il, passes away, they expect the country to fall within 2 years, and they would be in favor of South Korean leadership. Could you discuss that?
Yeah, we did discuss that a little bit. Let me just ask a side question here, though. You can reiterate some of what you said, but how ill is Kim Jong-il?
Kim Jong-il's health, no one knows, but the fact that he is almost on a daily basis, maybe at the rate of once every 2 days, he's going out, for so-called on-the-spot guidance kind of tour, countryside and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
And he made a couple of trips to China, and he seemed to be not dying, at least. Of course, he suffered from some sort of stroke a couple of years ago, but that could have impaired some physical, some body parts. Maybe one of the hands is not as free and so forth. But his mental faculty seemed to be very focused still. It's not tarnished.
Mm-hmm.
So as long as he maintains his life, he will be the leader. The leadership succession has not occurred yet. There are a lot of rumors and so forth. But it may happen next. Someone said 3 to 5 in South Korea. Someone's 3. He will live for 3 to 5. And if it is 5, that's a substantial time.
Right.
So that's that. Now, will North Korea collapse even Kim Jong-il dies today? I don't think North Korea will collapse that easily because it has the all kinds of infrastructure in the command system with the military and it will have a collective leadership and so forth. The system will not demise that quickly. When Kim Il-sung died in 1994, a lot of people predicted that the system will collapse within months, not years. So now we're into 16th year. A system's collapse requires legitimacy crisis on the part of the people. And as long as the people are fed, they're given education and so on, people will support that system. Whether Kim Jong-un's new leadership will be able to feed the people, that is the critical test for the leadership succession or success. And therefore, and I wouldn't, given the Chinese food aid and economic aid, as long as that China may want to unify the Korea, but not necessarily in democracy, South Korea absorbing North Korea, I don't think it's in Chinese interest. And I don't think anyone in authority would have said that. Mm-hmm.
So China would prefer not democracy, but what?
Well, the status quo.
I see.
Really. China cannot envision the possibility of unified Korea under North Korean terms. Mm-hmm. It's unthinkable given the economic and other, establishment of the South. So I think the countries surrounding the peninsula would love to see the status quo without North Korea nuclear weapons, without actually military confrontation. If you can sustain the status quo, may be sustained. It's fine for the United States too. We export a lot of weapons to South Korea. In fact, South Korea is number one importer of American weapons. So a lot of people in the United States may be very happy about the status quo. Division will last for some time.
Mm-hmm. Thanks, Pat, so much for your call. Let's go to Habu from Madison. Hi.
Yes, good morning, and thank you. And this is a very good conversation with a guest who intimately knows this, unlike our national media, who are just spouting off. But anyway, it was what the guest just said about the American involvement. I think we need to say a little bit more about this. I think it's horrendous that in this day and age, in the United States of America, where millions have lost their homes, there's great unemployment, which is the average is about 22-25%, and here, in response to trying to make parts of the world more at peace, we do the opposite and send aircraft carriers and show all this force. Nobody's fooled. The people in North Korea, the administration, know exactly what they're doing. And there's a lot heaped on them, the Hermit Kingdom, the boy president, the sinking of the Cheonwon. A lot of these things have been disputed if you listen to other media from around the world. Mm-hmm. It's not this American babble that you get, which is just focused on demonizing North Korea. Remember how the run-up before Iraq? I rest my case.
All right. Thanks very much for the call. Response, Professor Park?
Yes. So we seem to have a lot of attitudes before having rational assessment of facts in Washington and all over the Western world. Everyone seemed to have some attitudes, mostly negative. But these attitudes are really blindfolding decision makers, foreign policy makers. And I think it's time for us to try to collect as much information as possible. You can read between lines. Although North Korea is closed, but there are a lot of countries, more than 100 countries, maintain diplomatic ties. And if you go to North Korea, there are a lot of foreigners roaming around, too. So we can collect information, not as much as we would like to, But the problem is with our attitudes, we are blocking. We think we know everything about North Korea, at least enough to make a decision. But decisions are pre-made, and then we're trying to justify the decisions with the selectively collected and perceived facts. And I think that's an irony of American foreign policy and in tragedy.
What about the reports we're getting of North Korea contributing to make the world a less safe place? I reference the secret American intelligence assessments concluding that Iran has obtained advanced missiles based on a Russian design much more powerful than anything Washington has publicly conceded that Tehran has in its arsenal. And they obtained 19 of the missiles from North Korea, missiles that could give Iran the capacity to strike at capitals in Western Europe or to reach Moscow.
See, North Koreans, the only source of foreign currency is the sales of weapons, especially missiles. When your people are starving, your country is desperate, they will do just about anything. What we should be much more alarmed by is the sales of these sensitive weapons to even non-state entities, potentially. I think that non-proliferation should be our goal rather than regime change around the world.
Let's go to Carl from Houston. Hi, Carl.
Hi.
Hi.
Hello.
Yeah, my comment is about WikiLeaks. WikiLeaks said that China was talking about North Korea as a misbehaving child, which I agree with that statement because North Korea is being fed by the Chinese, and it is like their child. So I feel like this is a China problem. And secondly, I agree with that other caller. You know, the United States has too many internal problems to focus on all these other countries, and, you know, especially when China is like our stepchild because we helped build them into this great superpower. Now they need to step up the plate and, you know, bring peace to that region, their own backyard. That's my comment, and I'll take that off.
All right, Carl. Thanks very much. Professor Park?
China being our stepchild is a little bit stretched. In any case, North Korea receives a lot of aid and expect to receive even more. North Korea seems to have adopted the China model for its own development. So there will be a lot of interaction between the two. North Korea being a misbehaving child, certainly, from China's point of view, they would like to see North Korea give up its weapons program, nuclear weapons program. And North Korea is very stubborn about that, hanging to it as the only leverage, if you will. That doesn't make China happy. So there are certain elements in what North Korea is doing that do not please Beijing. So maybe, you know, that WikiLeaks may have gotten some of it. But I don't think it's official Chinese attitudes or policy toward North Korea.
What's happening today in China? I understand there are top-level government officials from North Korea, or at least one in China. Do you know what's going on?
They have embassies, of course.
Sure.
And in both sides, the diplomats, ambassadors, are senior ambassadors, both sides, because of course, each is very important to the other, especially China is vital to North Korea. If we just let the natural course go, within a couple of years, North Korean industries, all the economic zones that they're about to develop will be completely overwhelmed by the Chinese presence. So there may be little room for the United States or South Korea to creep in there if we just let the China-North Korea relations blossom as it is doing now.
Mm. Professor Park, as always, a great pleasure to speak with you. Have a productive session with the Canadian government, and thank you for your time this morning. I know you're a very busy guy.
Thank you for inviting me again. Thank you. I enjoyed it.
Good. I'm glad you did, because it means we'll invite you again. Professor Han S. Park, he is in Ottawa at this very moment, and he'll be briefing the Canadian government on North Korea in about a half hour. He's professor of international affairs, director of the Center for the Study of Global Issues at the University of Georgia, and has just a profoundly interesting life. He was born in China. His parents from Korea, educated in China, Korea, and the United States, and he has facilitated these very large exchanges and diplomatic missions with American officials, including former President Jimmy Carter and top-level North Korean officials. All right. Thanks to Chrissy Pease for producing this hour, and thanks to Chrissy as well for on-air production. We have to move to an open line because Matt Taibbi is sick today. So our lines are open for your suggestions for upcoming shows.